From the flower movement of Syria that turned into a bloody revolution with guns on both sides, to the Libyan civil war, which came into existence February 17, 2011, to the Bahrain demonstrations, which started out with 15 people and resulted in half their population. Half a million people were out in the streets protesting a 230-year-old monarchy. These are the stories of a documentary called We Are the Giant. It is the ground root level of the Arab Spring, the decisions and plans of average civilians with compassion and a purpose that had no idea how they were going to confront their governments and had little chance of winning. But with one act of courage, they chose that. They chose no longer to be suppressed by sometimes 40 to 200-year regimes. I'm going to play a clip for you while I, before I draw in my co-host. This is a clip of two sisters that spent 12 years of their life growing up in Denmark because their father was an exiled human rights leader from Bahrain. And there comes a point where they decided to take action and return to their country and demonstrate in the, it's called the Pearl Roundabout in the center of the country. Now, Bahrain is a country, it's a giant island with an archipelago of a series of islands around it. It's right, it's centered in the Middle East near Saudi Arabia. There's only 1 million people, but Bahrain and Tunisia were two of the primary countries that started the Arab Spring in action. With that, I'll play this clip.
My father is known internationally. He's worked with numerous international human rights organizations. He would be invited to train people on how to become human rights defenders. Has made people believe more that this cause is something they need to do. Right? Any government that kills its own people is a government that needs to go. People are demanding human rights. They're demanding dignity. And if you have actually 50% of the population taking part, these are actually the largest protests that have happened in what is called the Arab Spring. I think the protests reached the point where it was either that the regime stepped down or that they cracked down with an iron fist.
Bahrainis are a peaceful people. The first time I saw a gun in my life was in a Walmart in America. And that's how it is in Bahrain. Everyone's like that. The only people who have guns here are the police and army.
At that point, a lot of people left the square because they felt that, okay, this is not safe because they're going to start attacking.
I decided I had to, like, come back home because I have a daughter. Her name is Jude. And I was so worried about Jude that she wouldn't have her mom or her dad.
And when she left, I felt like I completely understand that. If I had a daughter, I'd do the exact same thing. But I also knew that I had to be there. I knew that we'd need everyone on the ground in case something happened. I was the only member of my family that was in the square. There was 2,000, 3,000 people. And with no prior warning, they started shooting. started running through the villages. And of course, my sister called me and she was freaking out. Where are you? I'm coming to get you. And I was like, don't come. The situation is too dangerous.
It was scary. And I was asking her, Maryam, where are you? Where are you? And I was just like running and I couldn't really get what she was saying.
What they were doing, they were closing off the entire area. So they weren't doing it in a way where they wanted people to leave. They were closing it off to make sure people couldn't leave. So I'm more or less went into hiding.
I'm going to start the actual show now because John and Don are on the line. Now, this is the clip that I just played was about two women that their father was a civil rights leader exiled in Denmark, as I already stated. They decided to come back to Bahrain in 2011 because their father wanted to, and they knew that they could not, there was no way they could not get involved with the movement regarding trying to overthrow a 230-year monarchy. Now, believe it or not, the United Kingdom had a hand in Bahrain in 1971. Bahrain declared their independence from England. Also, in a way, colonialism and the United States government had a strong hand. We've always tried to overthrow Gaddafi in Libya. But now, did anybody know that Libya is still run by only a provisional government? And there's over 12 factions there. The General National Congress is really the only legitimate arm of the government there. Gaddafi ruled there from 1969 to 2011. They have 6 million people only in the country. Their GDP is $91 billion. And in the other country, Bahrain, that I'm focusing on, the GDP is $93 billion, and they only have 1 million people. So these are oil-rich countries. Bahrain and places like Kuwait and Qatar have been supported by U.S. corporations and NATO. But actually, Libya has always been kind of an outsider. With that, I'll bring in my co-host. I'll say hi to John first and then Don. Good evening, John.
Hi. What's up?
Hi. How are you doing tonight?
You can hear
me?
Yes,
I'm probably going to call in on my landline. I accidentally called in on my cell phone. So,
okay, because...
But how are you doing tonight, Don, after your camping experience?
I'm beyond tired, but it's a good tired. I've been traveling for the last 3 weeks pretty much nonstop, and came home from Cincinnati, the NACP National Convention, and my family that I left home, my daughter and son and all the grandkids wanted to go with us, go camping to our camp share property in Grass Valley. So we just came back from there, Grass Valley, California, and Nevada.
Cool.
And so we just came back, and maybe I can get a day of sleep in.
Good, I hope you do. John, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, doing excellent, Comrade Hofanowski. Very good.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Hi, John.
I just got off the phone. I'm trying to dial in on my home phone. The reason I decided to feature I Am the Giant in the first part of this show is because it's a dramatic account of two people in three different countries that try to fight the government. The depressing part of the movie is when you go up against authoritarian regimes, you generally die. you don't make a lot of progress. But one thing you may not know that in Syria, before there was an actual full scale civil war, there was a thing called the flower movement, where the younger generations carried flowers in the street and they were peacefully protesting Bashar al-Assad. But then after the government just decided to attack them with weapons, they decided to get their own resistance and got their own guns. And after that, that's when a lot of the refugees fled because they couldn't handle the violent confrontation. And it got a lot worse when both sides were using violence to try to solve the problem.
Sounds normal to me in any confrontation. The conflagrations are because somebody gets guns and other people don't have them, and then they seek out their allies, quote unquote, to get guns, and then both have guns, and everybody has guns, and next thing you know, everybody's shooting at each other. Sounds very, very familiar. Kind of like the American history, where it was based on one faction of guns, and they just came in and just blew everybody away. Now they think they're all that in a bag of chips.
Can you guys hear me better now?
Not really, but go for it.
Okay, well, I'm on the land phone now. I just want to mention two things about this movie, and then if Albert does not call in, we're probably only going to spend 15 minutes on it. And then we never heard your synopsis of the NAACP convention, so can compare the two, because I also want to discuss that shooting in Florida by the caregiver for the autism person. But I want to finish up what I was talking about, because that's the headliner. I Am the Giant documentary, it was produced. Now, there's 6 stars in this movie that, you know, are actual protesters. I hope that they're out of the line of danger, because after going on a live reel, and this was portrayed at the Sundance Festival in 2014, there's no way that their lives could be safe after starring in this film. But basically, the first scenario is about Libya. See, the problem with Gaddafi is he had rule since 1969, and it only was a handful of young men, like 50 of them, who started out with the resistance. They didn't even have really proper training with guns or anything. Well, anyways, a 20-year-old guy by the name of Muhannad, Muhannad, Ben Sadiq, who grew up in the state of Virginia in the United States, his father was from Libya, and Muhannad decided to go back. And once he got there and he saw the unrest with the government, he decided to get involved. He learned how to use a gun. And then the government stalked them out with big tanks in these smaller cities. But one night he was left behind when it got dark, and he got separated from the group, and he got killed. So his father, Osama Ben Sadiq, who wept many times throughout the film, said that he hoped that his son didn't die in vain. But he told his father, "I can't be afraid. I need to stand up to this government. There is no other choice for me." So in the second segment of the film, there were 2 Syrians, and their name was Ghassan Yassin and Motez Murad. And basically, they were involved in the ground level with the flower movement. And what happened after a while is the Syrian government became ruthless, and they started going into people's homes and killing them in cold blood right inside their homes. So one of the guys, I believe it wasn't Ghassan but Motaz, he was actually a mechanical engineer in Syria. He was no slough. You know, a lot of people think that nobody has good jobs in these countries, but they have universities there and all this other stuff. Well, both him and his friend Ghassan, they lasted quite a while, but eventually their lives got threatened too. And I really don't know what happened to them, but once it turned violent, then there's continual bombing. In fact, this weekend, 77 people died by a U.S. drone in Syria, including children. So the war is continuing. In Libya, there is still a provisional government with 12 different factions trying to rule, and about 3 of the 12 factions are ISIS-controlled. And I feel like Armageddon's already come to certain points of the world. Like, you know what I mean? There's no hope for these people. Their cities are destroyed. They have little food to eat, and it's a terrible mess. Does anyone have a comment?
I would say you're going to see more and more of this across the world. You're going to see unstable governments. You're going to see rise and fall, and it's going to escalate more. You have to have a strong leadership. You have to have military strength to stabilize people. And if you don't, all these terrorist factions rise up, and you're just going to have chaos. So at some point, we have to realize what's happening in our country. And we're getting a destabilized society where you have people uprising. And if that continues, at a certain point, government will rise up and take charge. They'll declare martial law. So sometimes people have to be very aware of what they're fighting for, and what the cause and effect of when you begin to disrupt, society, by making a big scene, because pretty soon you're going to have the military step up and squash, whatever the resistance is.
Well, the thing is, John, you're right about that. With the resistance in the United, we can use this as a segue into what Don's going to be talking about. See, for example, with the Rodney King riots, that lasted, 3 days to a week. And I had friends whose safety was impaired because of it. Then we had the Occupy Wall Street movement, which was relatively peaceful, but in some cities people got kicked out of areas after 30 days. They just didn't want them around. Now, in Los Angeles, they were pretty tolerant to those people. But in a lot of cities, they were just kicked out after a while. The city government and the police didn't want to deal with the mess. Now, in Minnesota, after Philando Castile was killed, even after they did the investigation and Mark Dayton stood up for the black movement in Minnesota, he said if it was an actual governor said that if Philando had been white, he would not be dead now. So that was a pretty strong statement. He went to his funeral with the lieutenant government, but they still camped out in front of his house for 3 to 4 weeks and then were eventually kicked out. Really, our country doesn't, except for maybe certain groups, we really don't know what real oppression is, being shot dead for even trying to speak. Now, I know Don might disagree with me, but that's my belief.
All righty then. That was the funniest thing I've heard. In this country, we don't know what it means. I just want to know why did Don and Jane, why do we have these uprisings in America, these riots, these protests since, 1691 when we first populated the United States, or 1492 when we were on the boat, everybody, and still were throwing out the piss water overboard. I'm wondering why, if you guys can answer me this, why then do we still have riots? Why do we still have police shootings from blacks who are from angry black people? And why does this go on then? I know
why it goes. I didn't say that there was no wrongdoing in America or no reason to resist. What I said is that, well, you might disagree with this too, but people who work and don't actively participate in protests can pretty much survive in America. Now, some people have to fight harder to survive, but I don't think our government directly tries to oppress us unless the oppressor just decides to become oppressive one day, as noticed in the police who make bad decisions lately in the news the last 3 or 4 years.
This is not anything lately. Do you know what a picnic is and why you should never, ever say that word again? Do you know what it is?
I just heard it recently in the news, but actually, no, I don't.
Okay, well, it's a regular old white person get together where they have chicken and watermelon and green collard greens, and they might even throw in some chitlins because they're out to witness a Sunday afternoon lynching of one, two, three black men who may or may not have been guilty of anything. That's what a picnic is, a pick a nigga. And that's what that's why, as I mentioned before, blacks are against a lot of things that are going on in this country that's symbolic, that is a reminder of the good old past days that we can just relish in when we can say our brothers and sisters are the main feature of a Sunday party in the park. That's exactly why we love this country. And, you know, and that's why so many ISIS, other kinds of groups like the Black Panthers and you know, everyone else, any other groups that you can think of that may or may not be militant are created in the first place. So if you want to go to a picnic, hey, I'm not scared. And that's the one thing that the Republicans, John, are just preaching fear up the yin-yang. And we know as black people that we can't be scared. Because if you're scared, the white man can smell it, and he comes after you extra fast and extra hard, and you get incarcerated or killed for just being innocent, for just being black.
Well, I do believe that based on all – I'm not in the dark, but lately, obvious things in the news point to that trauma. Now, on the other hand, Don, on the other hand, I did find something good about Tim Kaine today, that he stood in Washington, D.C. with a small group of people to commemorate all the children that died in Syria, and he's very missionary oriented. I also understand he has a long history of civil rights actions. Are you familiar with that, Don?
You can ask John. This guy has come out of he's come out of left field, and it's ready.
Oh, by the way, he was born in St. Paul, Minnesota. Woohoo!
Oh, yeah. Well, great. You know, bottom line is that he came out of left field. He looks like he who knows what. And then we're just going to have to deal with what goes on between whomever to see whatever's going on. This is crazy. I don't know what Hillary's thinking.
I know what she's thinking. He's a white male. He's Catholic. And he's been served as a Jesuit missionary in Honduras. He's fluent in Spanish. There's no way a woman could not pick a white male in the presidential race. She
Whatever.
Has to go up against Trump and that other man, Mike Pence.
Right. Mike Pence. You know.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
God. But I just am hoping that Hillary becomes a nice person.
Who's making all that racket in the background? Is it you, John, doing your laundry?
No, I'm just sitting here listening to the circus.
Listen, Don, I think you're the one making the racket.
Okay, hold on.
Whatever you're doing, it sounds like you're microwaving 6 or 7 dishes. Well, in the meantime, John, can you make a comment?
Well, I think, you know, we all have our own experiences. California, at some level, you know, may be different than the Deep South. Maybe it isn't. But I've never been to a lynching or had a picnic or people celebrating that. I think there's kind of this idea that the whole country is just white people suppressing black people. And the majority of us that aren't black grew up thinking, where is all this coming from? I mean, I go to the corner store. I don't see lynchings there. I do see Crips. I do see homies in the street. So I think there's a certain point where we have to be careful who we're labeling or where all the problems of the world are coming. Are white people following black people and just everywhere you go and suppressing them? I don't know. Mexicans are suppressed. Jews have been suppressed for years. You know, genocide for every country they go. They seem to succeed no matter what. So I think there's a certain point where Tim's story is in Hollywood. He's kind of on Oprah's channel. You know,
Tim Kaine.
Just talking about letting this make excuse where you're at. Take your situation, move forward. Go, you know, like make. Don't live in the my brother did this, my uncle did this, my great granddad did this. You know, a lot of times fingers are pointed at like so the actions of someone like four generations.
Hello? It appears that John got cut off.
Okay, what happened? Hello? Hello?
Don?
Yeah.
John got cut off, but he just called back in, so hold on a second.
Okay.
John, I saw that you got cut off. Is that you, John?
No, I'm here. You know, maybe my phone can handle my... Hello?
Yeah.
You're going to have to turn your volume up. I can't hear you, John.
Okay, well, my volume should be up.
No, I'm talking to John, J-O-N.
Can you hear me now?
A little better.
I can hear you.
Yeah, maybe my phone couldn't handle my rant, but... I was just going to say, I think at some point, each one of us, we have to look and say, what am I doing with my life? How can I make things better? You know, I can look back and say, you know, I'm part Indian. It's like a white man took my you know, the land I lived in. Or I could say I'm Hispanic and, you know, the white man did. But at some point, I just have to make the best of what I've got. You know, and not just blame people where I'm at. You know, I mean, does it play into where I'm at? Absolutely. When I came to L.A., there is a white circle of people that are successful, and I didn't fit into that. You know, but I understood that. I just had to go with reality and just move forward, make it better. You know, and you know, I work in Marina Del Rey. I live on the West Side. You gotta work with your situation, you know.
Well, you live in a good neighborhood, and technically you're kind of like Obama. You can move between two different cultures. I mean, you're not bound
to race. I had to work my butt off, save my money, and put a deposit down and buy a condo in the West Side for $75,000. It was just a smart business move, but there wasn't a coalition of white people saying you can't buy here or live here. You know, I go to Marina Del Rey, go to the Whiskey Red along the water, and half the time the events there are like 40% African-American. I go to Chase Burton Park, and in the weddings and the social parties and things, it's African-American. It's a high density for that area. I just think, you know, no one's stopping that. There's not white people running out there going, you can't meet here. It's like, no, it's America. Now, is there racism? Yes, there is, you know. Is there a double standard? Yes. But I'm just saying, in a lot of cases, you just got to figure out a way of how to improvise, you know, work through it.
You guys, we did have a guest log in the chat room, and we also have to keep this show within the scope of what the title was, because they've already logged out. So I do. Can I mention something? And well, first of all, comment on what John said. First of all, I've actively gone into other cultures and regions that were not of my origin. For example, I went to North Carolina to an all-black college. I was the only white living on campus. I wanted to be a civil rights leader. I had no idea what I was doing back then at age 19, but I knew that I wanted to make a difference in the world. Sometimes it's easy as an adult, now that I'm 55, to get stuck in my ways and just worry about making a living and surviving and taking care of my son, like not overextending yourself. So people can fall into that trap too. I do see Don and his wife, they often extend their financial comfort zone to go on all these trips to make a difference with the NAACP or the Democratic Party or lobbying. So I see them going out of their comfort zone. As long as we feel like we're being useful, I think that's the most important thing. Don?
Yeah.
Well, Don, one thing that I don't like what you've been doing on the show lately is you've been hypercritical of a lot of the top leaders in our country. For example, you have to emphasize what the good that Hillary Clinton's doing, not just the bad. And maybe you want to comment on Debbie Wasserman Schultz's crisis today that pretty much got her kicked out of the head chair position.
She didn't get kicked out. She resigned because she's been doing what Hillary Clinton has wanted her to do for the last 2 years. And that's exactly why you were wrong when you say Hillary, you have to give her credit for something, because she hasn't done much of anything since she's been been a wife of Bill Clinton.
Okay, but are you saying that Hillary Clinton instigated the demise of Bernie Sanders through Deborah Wasserman Schultz?
Absolutely.
John, did you hear the Democratic chairs stepping down because some emails were leaked that they were trying to sabotage Bernie Sanders even before his popularity increased? I don't
John?
Feel like everybody's with the program. Now wake up.
Where's John?
I'm listening. It's hard to tell whether you're saying John or Don.
I noticed that Don answered twice when I said John. So he's probably just going hard of hearing.
Well, I think there's a little bit of distortion on your call, too. So they sound different. But, you know, one thing I can comment regarding Hillary, you know, her roots are kind of socialistic. I'm talking from her college days, and I think all of us, we have our own roots. Like, I'm a Christian, and, I was a radical Christian when I was a teen. So in my heart of hearts, I really feel like the world needs to follow Christ and that, you know, the materialism that we seek is not the answer. And that's at my roots. And I think part of what Hillary, whether intentional or not, is part of, you know, what we call the conversion of America. The Russians used to have spies they would send over here. They wanted to overthrow America, but they decided not to use weapons, but rather to infiltrate into our entertainment and into our media, into our colleges. And, you know, basically, you know, kind of the message is, what you do is you control the society by basically through health care, poverty, debt, gun control, welfare, education, religion, class welfare, and warfare. You know, when I grew up, my dad worked to support the family. Mom would stay home. He had two kids, a house. Didn't have a picket fence, but, you know, it was pretty cool. We had one car in the garage. And you look in my lifetime, what's changed? Well, women work now. They don't get married. people stop having babies. You know, the loss of the male, the man. And now we're promoting transgender. We're promoting a gay lifestyle, anti-family. How did this happen? It's in the entertainment. It's in the music. It's in the media. You know, people don't go to church on Sunday now. Stores are open Sunday. No one gets married. It's a different culture. The whole society has changed. It's flipped. And now to promote marriage and going to church, all that stuff, it's like archaic. It's antique. Who goes to church on Sunday? Everyone's going to the beach, or they're going shopping, or they're going to Comic-Con in San Diego. You wouldn't have had this in my time. It's like, we'll go to that stuff. It was all about family and God, and, you know, it's changed. And, you know, this is part of the whole cultural sweep that's happening, you know. You've seen it in the news, all these riots, and, you know, we want to have gun control. Debt is bad. Poverty, we're printing more money than, you know, it's just 30 years of debt. Our kids will never get out of this. You know, that's how I think. Go ahead.
Well, would you, John, would you like to go on a pick-a-nigger with me?
I will fight with you, my brother. I will march with you. We will overcome.
Because that's what the symbolism of oppression is about, where things become normal that are violent. And that's the same thing with Syria and Libya. They're in their own world. Why would we, as the United States, or generally any other superpower that's not contiguous with them, bother them, blow them up, and then now make them mad at us, cause a vacuum in the Mideast?
I don't think it's a matter of being... See, what happened is, I guess I'm going off some not very devoted information, but there was a choice that Obama could have made 2 years ago about a red zone in Syria, which would have created more protection for the civilians. But he decided not to get involved. And by the way, Tim Kaine did support that. But now we have sneaky things going on in there, like a U.S. coalition killed 21 civilians last Monday, the 18th, and another 56 on Tuesday, the 19th, and children were killed. The strikes appeared to have been a mistake with the civilians taken for ISIS militants, the UK human rights group reported. But 56 civilians were killed, and it was a U.S. coalition probably involving the United Kingdom and some other European countries.
Well, you're talking about the secret war that we've been waging since about 14, where we keep bringing in more secret high-level troops or officers, and they're not supposed to be fighting, and we've got two of them down so far, and probably more to come. The one that Hillary Clinton is heading up and doesn't want to tell anybody that this secret illegal mission is going on, as usual.
Well, I guess Obama's done some things that are kind of on the cuff, too. He's been having secret negotiations with Iran, I read.
Right. And that's to make sure that they stay on the up and up until he's out of office with this Iran treaty. He fought to get this thing because, you know, his Muslim part of his family really wants him to make sure that he does right by the Iranians and anybody else in the Middle East.
I just want to read one more thing because this all ties into elitist oppression. Former U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates told the Business Insider that Obama's administration and their decision not to act after the regime of Syria's embattled president used chemical weapons against civilians was a serious mistake that hurt America's credibility in the world. Gates, who is promoting his book, A Passion for Be Quiet, for Leadership, sat down with Business Insider last week and gave his perspective. I used to tell presidents you have to be very cautious about drawing red lines or issuing ultimatums, the defense secretary said. As if I put it, if you cock the pistol, you have to be ready to fire it. The other problem is during that movie I was watching, We Are the Giant, Bush was rubbing shoulders with Bahrain, the monarchical government. Oh, John dropped again, but I'll have him call back in. John, I have you on the line again. George Bush was appeasing the constitutional monarchist. John dropped. John, are you there?
I'm here.
John, J-O-N in Santa Monica. You called in on two lines. Are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, yeah, because you called in on the 433 number, but then you dropped that, and now you're on the line with the 463 number.
Right. The 433 number tends to be a little bit noisier, so I thought I'd get a little more stable phone, you know, since we're talking about unstable governments. And I think a lot of these cases with these countries, you have, you know, kind of religious factions. You get kind of ISIS groups revolting and against, you know, the established government. And people, it's kind of free-for-all. But I think we're running into that, too, with our country. We're allowing, you know, people that are coming in that have, you know, a terrorist agenda. And it is something that if left unchecked, we're going to be as unstable as these other countries as we get more into debt, more into poverty, people begin to struggle. You know, it's like there's just a random kind of chaos going on. Every day you open the paper, which country is going to have a shooting or an assassination or, you know, some kind of terrorist attack? So I think it's just a level of chaos going all around the world that at some point we're all going to have to address, you know, each country.
They had two attacks this week, I believe, and one was by a 13-year-old boy.
The problem is you're going to have an alpha dog, and if you don't, you're going to have the pack is going to go crazy. You can't have 50 different alpha dogs. You know, you have to have someone take charge, stand up, and be strong. Or there's going to be chaos, you know, whether Hitler or whether, you know, Saddam Hussein, Donald Trump, you got to have a strong man. And if you don't, the bullies that are in the room start fighting and cannibalizing, you know, it's sad, but, you know, you look at history, capitalism and democracy and all that stuff, you know, in many ways is a new concept when you look at world history. It's always been kings and dictators and czars and, you know, leaders. You have to have strong leadership. If you don't, the society goes into chaos. It's a historical kind of it's just a habit of the way people function in society.
But there's two different kinds. I was going to ask you a question about George Bush, but I'll hold the question. There's two different kinds of leadership. If it's a cosmic or happy leadership, they can, like Bill Clinton, they can improve the economy and people can get better jobs. But if it's just a strong iron hand leadership like a Margaret Thatcher or a George Bush, people might not be as happy, but they obey out of fear. So I'm not saying people did that under George Bush, but he did rub shoulders a lot with Arab elitists like the Saudi royal family, the Bahrain royal monarchy, and others, and they didn't really do much about human rights in those countries when people called into question the actions of their government.
Well, you bring up some interesting points. Let's say in the case of Bush, when we went in, you know, realize we had 9/11, and whether, you know, some people think our government did it or not, the point is bad people did bad things to our country. The country was confused. George Bush stood up and was like, I'm going to carry the big stick. And everyone cheered and applauded. We actually were very proud and happy, and we felt safe. You know, no one messed with us. We went into, you know, Iraq, and we kicked some butt. The problem is we didn't have an exit plan. You know, it was very knee-jerk reaction, like, let's just go over there. Oh, wait a second. How are you going to get out of there? You destabilize the country. You take out the strong dog, the strong man. Now you're going to have a bunch of terrorist, crazy people who have fought for thousands of years. It's like we're not used to that. We're used to fighting, kicking some butt, and going home, like World War II. You know, and this is a situation like you don't just wipe your hands and go home. These people in the Middle East fight all the time. That's their lifestyle. We're not used to that. You know, we're used to white picket fence and that kind of culture. So the problem you run into is that's where we got disheartened with Bush. It's like it wasn't, you know, we didn't have an exit plan. And you look at Clinton, yeah, those were good times, but Bill was soft. You know, a lot of what happened, you know, some of that was set up by his behaviors, the deals we made with China, you know, with different, you know, the whole global type of deal. We started selling our country off, you know, 10, 20 years ago, and it's just continued. So there are repercussions, you know, for his actions. You know, our culture has slid terribly in the last, you know, and Bush had a part of that too. But, you know, Clinton, Bush, Obama, you know, it's just been a slide downward, I think, in my opinion.
Well,
by the way, Don, beyond the level of police officers and other members of society who are oppressed blacks, how do you account for random people such as Muslim-born, American-born Muslims who just go out and kill people regardless of race or where they're working or,
We're not talking about just police officers. We're talking about regular people, corporate people. We're talking about business people. We're talking about mom and dad. They all have aversions to black power. Go ahead. Now what are you talking about?
What I'm trying to say is that there's a lot of killing going on in the world right now, and many of the people who are victims, for example, in the San Bernardino thing, where it was just that Islamic guy's coworkers, they're randomly killed. They're targeted, but they did no wrong. In the same way that many black people who just walk the streets and have regular jobs get targeted. So how do you account for that in the context of American society and authority?
We're talking about jihad. Islam, just like any other set of religions, has its good and its bad. When you're a jihadist, when you believe in the I don't know what they call it, the Orthodox Quran or whatever they call it, but there is a segment of the Quran that does believe that Islam should be proselytized worldwide. It will become the standard religion in the future, and that they have to pretty much kill as many white people as they possibly can. Those are the Western civilization.
Whose objective is it to kill white people?
It's to whoever Western civilization is. Right now, that's white people. And so if there is a faction in Islam that Muslims believe in the elimination of Western civilization because it is run by the devil. You know, you can't blame them for that. That's their belief. So we have to live within the context of society, just like Don said. We have to live within the what we have as our, not rules and regulations, but as where we're living right now in the history of civilization. So that's what we have to figure out. We have to figure out how we can survive together. And in the jihadist case, there's nothing you can do about it. people in San Bernardino, you know, God rest their souls, Fort Hood. We've got all kinds of jihadist mass suicides, if you will, but suicide killing. So we're looking at the fact that the Islam has peaceful parts or believers also. They're the ones who are saying, hey, Allah is the greatest, but we have to live in peace and love with God. So that's, you know, that's two separate beliefs, and there are myriads in between that. So you can justify it by saying that the jihadists are just doing their job. And that's what everybody is tripping about that I've heard on the show and everything else, is that every, you know, they don't believe it, that everybody has a job to do. And the jihadist's job is to go to Munich or Nice or Brussels or wherever, you know, San Bernardino, and kill up as many white people as they possibly, or Western civilization inculcated people as they possibly can. And so,
okay,
why
can I interrupt you for a minute? The 18-year-old boy in Munich who was born to Iranian parents, he was in a mental health facility in 2015, then treated later as an outpatient. He had a fear of contact with others, but he was acculturated in Germany. He was born to Iranian parents. He got his gun underhandedly. It was a Glock pistol, and seven of the people he killed were teenagers, which were his peers. He was only 18, and he killed himself afterwards. I don't think that his style of killing has much to do with suppression of a status quo or white-dominated society.
Okay, whatever.
I think he was just a fuck-up.
He probably was, and he was a very good one at that. So throw him out of the jihadist equation, and you still have 88 people in Kabul, and you got 48 here and 27 there and 7 here and 14 there, whatever. The bottom line is that there's a reason for this, and the white man better look at himself in the mirror, because the American Revolution was started because of why? It was a revolution. Get over it and get with the program. You either with them, the revolutionaries, or you're with the status quo, the system. You know,
sometimes I feel like you're lecturing me and John. Why don't you get on board with us as a humanitarian? Like, just be human.
No. I'm trying. That's why I'm putting together the police. That's why I'm trying to put together the police forces for the community policing. That's why I was able to, you know, talk Al Sharpton into coming to Reno when he comes out west to give us a talk. We had three Black Lives Matter protests when we were gone, and we didn't participate in any of them because we were gone. But there was a letter to the editor in today's paper when I finally got a hold of it. And it was saying, why are we protesting? Why is there a factionalization of race concerns? And it kind of got to me, because it's like the pig digger. It's like you are completely, and she, the letter writer, is completely ignoring why this circumstance is happening, why there have been protests by blacks, whites, Indians, Hispanics since time immemorial in the United States. And nobody can answer it except for saying, well, I guess there's a problem. That's the stupidest crap I've ever heard in my life. and it's not a lecture, it's fact. I'm not trying to lecture anybody.
So have you met with the actual, John, by the way, we are concluding the show in 15 minutes. I'm going to read something out of Isaiah 17, but let's just let Don finish up here. Don, have you met with the actual the police department of Reno, and they said, why are you guys protesting or against us?
No, they understand. The police force understands where Black and Hispanic and Indians are coming from. They live it. You know, down in Los Angeles, they actually, in their off time, meet down in somebody's basement, and they learn the linguistics of the culture, specifically Ebonics and some of the gangs, the language and their texting, so that they can tap into all their resources. You know, that's what the police do. Sometimes on payroll and sometimes not. They're constantly trying to stay ahead of the game because the game is always changing. And it's changing so that the police don't have a one-up. But they know what's going on, and we're meeting with all factions. We've had one of the most successful discussions that we've ever had here when we left with the NAACP, Reno Sparks Branch. And we were able to talk to them, and they sat and listened instead of taking over and like they're normally doing question and answers. We just had a discussion. We just had comments that the public made to the police. The police would answer or would refute. But it was one of the most successful gatherings that we've ever had in the city, and that was when we left for Cincinnati. But, you know, we've been working very hard to bring about conversation with not only the police, the Reno police, but the Sparks police, Washoe County Sheriff, NHP, which is the Nevada Highway Patrol, the UNR, University of Nevada, Reno police, and the WCSD, which is Washoe County School District Police. So we've had been in discussion with all of them, and we're members of what we call 360 Green Ribbon Committee, and several other committees. Pat and I have gone on police training, and also car squad detail. They're inviting us to a seven-week course to show how the police are actually doing in action. We're right in the middle of everything, and I don't do anything that I don't do anything. I insist, you know, that's one of the reasons I quit my job just last week, because I insist on being right there so that I can witness and visualize exactly whomever is doing what, and I'll have an opportunity to expound on that then and in the future. I give, always give prescient feedback and relevant information, and that's
good.
That comes
I'm going to have to interrupt you a minute because we're getting towards the 60-minute hour. John, do you have a comment on what Don said, and then I want to go ahead with my conclusion.
No, actually, I think we should go to the conclusion because we are. I think we're going to, in a couple minutes, run out of time.
No, you know what happened last week? I want to mention Don's call dropped, and then Albert was fumbling on the line for 3 minutes saying hello, hello. So Blog Talk Radio did not fail us. I made the show tonight for 90 minutes because I thought Albert might be calling in, but he didn't. So now Don's call dropped. I hope he didn't feel like I insulted. Okay, anyways, John, now that I just have you on the line alone, the thing is that Well, I do appreciate John's contribution to the show, but it's not always the we-them syndrome. And I would have made the show more relevant tonight to what was going on in the Middle East, because that's what I advertised for, but our other co-host didn't call in. But I do think that no matter where the dying is taking place across the world, that there's a lot of it is authoritarian regimes. A lot of it are individual cases. For example, the one in Florida this week where a black caregiver was walking with an autistic client, and the cops didn't even have a reason to stop him. They made him lay on the ground, and he didn't move. And he still shot the black man, so I don't know if you heard about that. Those kind of things are disturbing. But I wanted to read this Isaiah 17 before the night is out. So let me just do my quick conclusion, and then you can go. See,
okay.
Damascus, okay, it's Isaiah 17, 1 through 10 or so. See, Damascus will no longer be a city, but will become a heap of ruins. The cities of Aurora shall be deserted, and left the flocks, which will lie down with no one to make them afraid. The fortified city will disappear from Ephraim, and the royal power from Damascus. The remnant of Aram will be like the glory of the Israelites, declares the Almighty. In that day the glory of Jacob will fade, the fat of his bodies will waste away. It will be as when reapers harvest the standing grain, gathering the grain in their arms, as when someone gleans heads of grain in the valley of Rephaim. Yet some gleanings will remain, as when an olive tree is beaten, leaving two or three olives on the topmost branch, four or five of the fruitful boughs, declares the Lord God of Israel. In that day, people will look to their Maker and turn their eyes to the Holy One of Israel. They will not look at the altars, the work of their hands, and they will have no regard for the Asherah poles and the incense altars that fingers have made. In that day, their strong cities, which they left because of the Israelites, will be like places abandoned to thickets and undergrowth, and all will be desolation. So all I'm trying to say is the prediction of the demise of Syria happened 5,000 years before the birth of Christ. And my general conclusion is this, is if the United States is going to be involved in helping the Middle East, then it has to be a firm stance. We can't go in there with quiet U.S.-led coalitions or drones or airstrikes and kill people. It's been noted in the last few years that the U.S. coalition and other European allies have killed 1,400 Syrians. That's nothing in comparison to the 450,000 that Bashar al-Assad has done. But the U.N. Commission on Human Rights warned Friday that 70,000 civilians were likely to be trapped in Manbij, and that the U.S. coalition should not have gone in there. It was already a big risk. So my conclusion is the world is a mess. We can only do as much as we can do, but we still have to be cautionary with what we do. So what's your conclusion?
My conclusion is most of these problems is government versus the common people. And you mix in, you know, extreme religious groups and other different groups that have an invested interest in money. You know, we do because of the oil and the land position. And you're going to have this problem until God takes over. I mean, basically, man is just meant for war and conflict. It's what we do. And it's just not, that's been the history of the world. It's always the ruling 3%, you know, oppressing the poor and those that are like slaves. So we're going to see more of this, you know, unrest, like the days of Noah, as we get closer to what we would call Armageddon. You know, it's just the nature of the beast till the beast arrives.
After watching that movie, I didn't realize how big of a mess it really was. It's just the whole country is in upheaval. I believe 1 to 2 million Syrians have already exiled to Turkey and the European areas.
Oh yeah, it's just a big, it's a big, big mess, and it's going to continue because, you know, we're not going to get that involved because it's a religious kind of conflict, and our culture, you know, what we believe, they don't embrace. So anything we do to destabilize the government or to fight with rebels, it's just going to cause more bloodshed, unfortunately.
Well, thanks for joining us. It sounds like you might have some company. So I'll let you go, and we're going to end tonight's episode with Alone, because the Syrian children and mothers are alone. And there was a picture on Twitter of a 2-year-old and the mother who was killed this week in Syria, and she had just celebrated his second birthday with a pretty birthday cake. So I'll dedicate the show to them. Thank you for joining us, and I'm cutting to the song. Good night.
Cool.
Good night. Good night, John. Have a good week.
Good night, Janessa. And good night, America.
Save the world.
One black person at a time. Let's all love each other.
One hard-headed cop at a time.
Yes.
Good night.
Good night.